So let's get to my guest, okay? So this is like a very big day for me. I have somebody from like another realm, basically. I hope she... Are you laughing? Are you laughing?
The Upper Side, yeah.
Yeah, the Upper Side. So this person generously offered to be on the show. And she lives on the Upper East Side. She came out to Bushwick. Suzanne Murphy, she's a... I don't know a lot of people. I've told her this. I don't know a lot of people like her, and I'm trying to think maybe the people that I think that are like her are maybe just not like her. She's like an incredibly successful in finance. In finance, can you believe I have somebody in finance that's successful in finance in the room with me, talking to me? Seriously, it's amazing, right? But it happened. Okay, shut up. So, who do you? So anyway, but she's obviously a brilliant woman because you can't make this happen. Her career isn't something that happens by accident. But I'm also very thrilled that she's here because I think that she has some life experiences that are going to be really helpful for all of us, every one of you guys, all right? I also might be nervous. I'm afraid of being nervous. I told her this. I'm afraid of being nervous because I have this really bad thing with authority figures. Suzanne, I told her I got fired from all the jobs, right? I got really afraid of authority figures. You guys know this about me. So I really like Suzanne, and I just hope that I don't get like nervous or any. There's counter transference that could be going on. Because, you know, she is somebody who is often in an authority position, I would guess. Certainly any room I'd be in outside of this studio, she would be in an authority position. So I'm just putting it out there in case you're suspicious of it. I'm owning it. Okay. Thank you, Suzanne.
My pleasure.
I didn't adjust the microphone close enough to your face.
Is that better?
Yes.
Okay.
So, thank you. So anyway, I'm just going to tell you my version of Suzanne, and then we're going to just get right into it. But I'm going to introduce her. Here's one sentence, because so you know what I'm talking about. Here's one sentence from her LinkedIn, okay? Listen to this, guys. You know what? This is like an art. This is like a financial expert's version of an artist statement. Suzanne Murphy is a senior marketer and investor relations executive who has been very successful at raising capital for a diverse range of alternative investment products. I don't know what it means. I don't know what it means, but we'll find out. We'll find out in a second. But I just want you to know that I have spent collectively several hours on the phone with this wonderful human being. And I will tell you, without a doubt, hands down, her most important, prized role is that of a mother. She has an 11-year-old daughter, Sydney B., who is an actress. And the two of them just seem incredibly close. And Suzanne has a very broad, very, very well-traveled, world traveler person, and I know that she understands humanity and is very, very open and curious, and she's just sharing that all with this young lady who is actually a working actress, which at 11, come on, guys, what did I tell you? These are ambitious people. She's also a very well-respected art collector. And she's a founding member of the Museum of Broadway. Check it out, themuseumofbroadway.com. It's organization that's close to our heart. And also, I just want you to know, these are two other relevant things. She was very close to her father. We'll hopefully get into that. And she's also, an exemplary athlete. She grew up performing, traveling, whatever. She was part of the United States World figure skating team, and she was an ice dancer. Okay, there you go. So, Suzanne,
I'm impressed with myself now.
Yeah, oh, good.
It's much better when you talk about it than when I do.
She's also really attractive, really good-looking woman, I got to tell you. Nicely dressed, great-looking woman, no doubt about it. So, anyway, can you kind of, like, just tell us, like, basically what you do for a living and comment on some of the things that I mentioned?
Sure.
I mean, what does that mean, what I read about you?
So, look, you're right. It's like an artist statement. It's a very fancy way of saying I raise money for investment products. Alternative investments are hedge funds, private equity, real estate, infrastructure.
But what are the skills? Like, does that mean that you go, like, I can't even understand that. Are you in meetings all day? Do you understand numbers? Like, what skill? What about you? What talents and skills? I mean, you're very good at what you do.
I think to be honest, it's being a good salesperson and exuding confidence and giving people confidence about the investment products you're representing.
Uh-huh.
I will tell you from my perspective, I would never try to sell or convince people to invest in something that I wouldn't invest in myself. So, that narrows the field and there's a lot of people out there that will try to sell anything. That's
so
not
you,
how I approach it.
You feel like you have a really good understanding of good investment products.
Yes.
And you have a track record now, obviously, to prove that. And so you ethics are important to you in what you're selling.
Very much so. I mean, I was very fortunate enough to be involved in a firm that we built quite successfully that we sold, which created a liquidity event that allowed me to form my own family office. So in addition to working with Lampe Conway, which is a fund that we're relaunching in the fixed income space, I make a lot of investments myself and work very closely with a former client of mine who advises me, but ultimately the decisions are mine and it's a broad range of different products. So you really need to understand what you're investing in from my perspective.
So when you go to sell, I'm just trying to picture this. When you go to sell a product, are you in like a meeting, like a very serious meeting with people that own companies? Like, is that it? What is it?
So it could be a very serious meeting with someone who owns a company. It could be just a very rich family. It could be a foundation or endowment, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, Harvard University, for example, has a very large endowment that they invest across a wide array of investment products. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of all of the above.
Mm-hmm.
But the key in alternatives is the investors have to be accredited. So, for an individual, that means a net worth of greater than $5 million.
Mm-hmm.
In general.
Mm-hmm. So do you mostly go out to sell these products or do people come to you or both?
It's a combination of both. I mean, before people actually want to invest, they want to see the offices, meet the entire team, kick the tires, make sure that there really is an office and there really are people there and there are the computers and all that kind of stuff. The world has certainly changed a lot since COVID and the rise of Zoom and other technologies like that, which is great. When I was a partner of the prior firm that I mentioned that we sold, I probably traveled 250 or 300,000 miles a year.
Wow.
I'd be gone for weeks at a time. Now becoming a mother obviously changed my ability and frankly desire to do that. And Zoom has been very helpful because you can get to the 20-yard line or the 10-yard line by phone calls and Zoom, whereas you used to go for the initial meeting because people wanted to meet you.
Right.
And when you're talking to somebody on the phone versus when you can actually look at them, it's a big difference.
So can I ask you to describe your office? Your office, it's at the company. You probably have an office at home. I just want people to understand what is possible.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say that the office is anything particularly fancy. I mean, it's in a building, Midtown Manhattan. We have a floor on Fifth Avenue and 54th Street.
You have like a couch in your office?
I do not have a couch in my office. I do. Well, we have the two named partners in this particular firm do have a couch in their office, which I end up sitting on a lot. But my office is, basically a desk and a couple of screens and computers and my iPad for Zoom meetings and things like that.
Do you feel under pressure all day long when you're there or?
No. I mean, it's what I do. And, I have to say, I joined the firm not long before the pandemic. So I haven't been in the office that much. I've been working pretty much from home, which at times, particularly when the kids were still out of school for the pandemic, could be a bit of a challenge because my apartment is structured more like a loft than a typical Upper East Side apartment building. So there were times when my daughter was home that there was no place to hide.
Okay. Okay, cool. Something that I think, or something that really stands out to me about you is your confidence. And this is something I think a lot of people struggle with, and a lot of women in particular. Okay, we're tired of talking about it already, but I have somebody who really genuinely has confidence or is able to use the confidence in a very effective way. So are you naturally confident? And let's talk about your confidence. I want to understand it. My hypothesis is that you had a very close relationship with your dad and you're good at sports. And I want to know how you became confident, if you are really confident, and if you doubt your confidence. Can you talk to us a little bit about confidence? Your
Sure.
experience of confidence?
Yeah, I think, look, most successful people suffer from what is frequently called the imposter syndrome. So I think all of us who exude confidence, you know, there's that little voice inside that says, wait, we're not really good at this, or they're going to find us out. But I think oftentimes that little voice can be what drives you to be successful, to continue to prove that that little voice is wrong, that you're not an imposter, that you really are good at what you do. There's no question that the experience of being an athlete at the level that I was growing up instilled that in me, right? And you had to go out and perform. You know, when it was time to do the competition, you had to turn it on. And I would probably say that if my ice skating coaches were here talking or reminiscing about, you know, what I was good at and what I was bad at, they would have said, you know, she didn't work as hard as she could have.
Mm.
She was naturally talented. And if she had worked harder, she really would have been good. But somehow I always pulled it out when it was time to perform, which drove them nuts. Because they would say, if you'd only worked, if you could do it that well, you could have been doing it, you know, twice that well. And so, there's definitely some of that, I think. But I think that gave me a lot of confidence, you know, having had the experience of getting up in front of lots of people and performing. You know, today I do a lot of speaking at conferences around the world. Can get up without a script and feel comfortable doing that. And I do credit my dad with a lot of that. My father worked on Wall Street. He actually retired when I was still in high school, but he really raised me as his son, you know, to follow in his footsteps, which I ended up doing. I think I shared with you the story that, you know, despite the fact that I grew up in a relatively affluent household, when I graduated from college, my father shook my hand and kissed me on the cheek and said, call home for advice, don't call collect, and don't call for money. You know, you're leaving college better off than most people. You have no debt. You've traveled the world. I've taken you places. And now you got to go figure it out for yourself. I mean, my father had worked on an ice truck when he was 8 years old.
So he was completely, completely self-made.
Completely self-made.
And how did you feel when you got to that point where you couldn't, you know, count, where they weren't going to be supporting you? Were you, as a young person, really anxious then? Or what did you do? Like, did you like, okay, I'm going to get a job?
Well, my father had warned me of this, you know, sort of before graduation. And I had a job lined up when I graduated from college, which was challenging because I graduated from college the year after the 1987 crash on Wall Street.
Oh, yes, I remember.
And training program slots went from, you know, Goldman Sachs might have hired 100 people the year before and they hired 12. But I had worked on Wall Street the 2 summers that I went to college. I actually graduated in 3 years, so I only had 2 summers, which was really stupid, by the way, because if you're listening out there, college is the least responsibility and the most freedom you'll ever have in your life. And I should have taken that extra year. I think I thought my dad was going to give me the year's tuition, which didn't happen. But, you know, I just buckled down and I chose to follow in my father's career path because he said, if you want to live the lifestyle which I've allowed you to become accustomed to, you better get a job that funds that lifestyle.
So you got a job on Wall Street right away? You have a bachelor's degree, right? You don't
have a master's degree.
Look at you idiots. wasting your money on art school. So,
look, I think there's a benefit to business school or law school. And I thought about going back to business school. My father didn't think it was necessary.
You know,
it ended up not being. And he was kind of smart because he said, look, you want to go back to school because you want to get back on the dole. You know, mm-hmm. if you want to go to business school, pay for it yourself. And I guess I didn't want to do that. But it ended up not being a problem for the career path I chose. I mean, right. I think the best thing and my college boyfriend went to Harvard Business School. The best thing you get out of it is the network of people that you meet, mm-hmm. you know, much more so than in the college. Education. You learn a lot on the job.
And where did you go to school?
I went to Wheaton College in mm-hmm. Norton, Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. There's two Wheatons, by the way. One's in Chicago. It's a Christian religious affiliated mm-hmm. seminary mm-hmm. school. Mm-hmm. I'm Jewish, so that was not me. And when I went to Wheaton, it was still an all women's college.
Mm-hmm. So you made some connections there?
Something, but not a lot.
I
really had to do it on my own. I mean, there were not a lot of women or girls that graduated from school and followed the same career path I did.
So what were the early days of working? That must have been a horror. I'm sorry. Like that environment, I'm overwhelmed just picturing it. Like, can you imagine this guy's like a really heavy duty Wall Street office where you have to like, as a woman, as an attractive young woman, oh my God, what was that like?
Look, I was prepared for it. My mm-hmm. father sort of counseled me that working on a trading desk on Wall Street is like being in a football locker room. And if you're not up for that, it's not the right world for you. I remember him saying, check the fact that you're a woman at the door. Nobody gives a shit. Dr. Lisa gives a shit, but nobody else gives a shit. You know, check the fact you're a woman at the door and conduct yourself with decorum. And look, it was different, right? We've had the Me Too movement now. There's a mm-hmm. lot more checks and balances, mm-hmm. particularly at the larger firms. But back in the day, I'll be honest, I had a situation where I was working for a firm which will remain unnamed, and we had a retreat that basically the whole firm was, you know, on this weekend retreat, and 11 o'clock at night, the CEO of the company shows up at my door in a bathrobe. And I had the presence of mind to say, I think you've got the wrong room.
Oh, wow.
And just,
oh, wow. That's impressive.
And
wow.
You know, and I just closed the door, and I knew I wasn't going to get fired, and I wasn't going to make a big deal of it. And I just went about my business.
Wow.
I think some of what's gone on with Me Too has gone too far.
Yeah.
And I think it's hurting women in business.
I could definitely agree with
I mean, I had lunch that. A few weeks ago with a guy who's got a very senior job at one of the big investment banks, and his office is right off the trading desk and it's got all glass. He's not allowed to have a one-on-one meeting with a woman. He has to have somebody else in the room. Not good.
That's not a good vibe. Although I'm glad the company is treating it that way. So when you start,
yes and no though, because these men now
don't have jobs.
They don't have the incentive to mentor women.
Yeah, well that's true too. We're all working on this shit as a society. And I know my listeners are really working hard on it. Good work, guys. I'm sure of you. I believe in you. So were you like confident right off the bat, or did you feel like you had to prove yourself? Was it heavy duty pressure in those early days, or?
All of the above. You know, I was insecure, but exuded confidence, and I just buckled down and worked really hard.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Wall Street, I started out on the sell side. Now I'm what's considered the buy side with investment products. Mm-hmm. I was selling equities at first and then convertible bonds on a Wall Street trading desk. It's a relationship business.
Mm-hmm.
So I sort of figured out very early on that I was young and green. And I remember calling on a bank in Chicago, and the guy who ran the convertible bond book at that particular bank was a pretty well-known guy in the industry. And I remember going out to see him. He said, why would I do business with you? You know, I can do business with firms that have a lot more capital than you have and with salespeople that know a lot more than you do. You're green. You're just out of school. I said, because you're going to teach me the business.
Wow.
You're going to be my mentor. And
wow.
I'm going to work really hard for you because I'm going to learn everything I need to know to be successful from
wow.
you. And that resonated and worked really, really well for me.
Yeah. I think your father, I mean, we have talked like I said, guys, we have spent a couple of hours total on the phone. Like, your father sounds like a pretty special guy, right?
He was amazing.
And I'm curious to know what about your relationship, like, what did you learn about men or dealing with men, or what do you think? I mean, you're obviously, you know, bright or brilliant, really kind of money. It's money. It's hard. You're a very accomplished woman. We know this. But I have this feeling like your father really imparted some kind of, you know, intangible, what did he give you? What did you get? Can you explain? Because I don't even know how to ask the question. What I'm trying to figure out is, like, what about your relationship with him helped you understand how to work with men in business, maybe? Maybe that's the question I'm trying to ask.
Yeah, I mean, my parents were divorced when I was an early teenager, you know, 12 or 13. And I lived primarily with my dad. And so I was exposed to his experience, his work. You know, when I went to Wall Street, he said, this is, you know, if you can't do this job, no one can, because it's like a racehorse that's been bred to do this.
Uh-huh.
And so I was very familiar with the terminology, with how Wall Street worked, you know, probably much more so than a lot of my peers, because I just grew up around it. And I grew mm-hmm. up around my father's colleagues because mm-hmm. they were his friends. And, mm-hmm. you know, those were the people that were sort of around when I was growing up.
Was he a very social man?
He was a very social man.
So you were actually probably surrounded by people who were having a good time and enjoying each other, right?
Certainly, you know, in my early years, I think, as I mentioned earlier, my father retired when I was still in high school.
Right. Mm-hmm.
He had decided that he had had enough, which, I, you know, look, I think is a very healthy attitude. He had enough money that everything, yeah. he had everything he wanted to live a good life. And the things he didn't have, he didn't see a path to achieving. So mm-hmm. he said, why would I keep doing this? And mm-hmm. and listen, I mean, you know, sometimes I've been criticized or people have said things that, you know, I went to Wall Street for the money. But that's why you go to Wall Street. It's not, you are doing good in the world because you need markets that work. But, you know, if you really want to do good in the world, you go work for a not-for-profit, or you go work on a kibbutz, or you know, go farm and, you know, Africa, but, you know, you go to Wall Street when you want to make money.
But I also would say that whatever it takes to be good at that, you have a knack for it.
Right? I happen to believe that you can be, being a natural salesperson really helps.
Yeah. I mean,
and you are born with that.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know.
You can hone it, but.
Yeah. I mean, you know, like the, just like anybody, you know, if your dad's great at fixing cars, you're probably going to be natural at fixing cars because it gets in you. You know, it's like your mother speaks French. You're going to speak fluent French. I mean, it makes so much sense. Plus the genetic talent. But I'm going to say that it's really funny, or what interests me is that it seems like you really have the talent and you naturally went into Wall Street, but that people are critical. It feels like people are critical of it, or that, like, in other words, my dad was an architect. I wound up doing, you know, graphic design art. You know what I'm saying? Like, why should it be any different for you? But except that people... Do you feel like people have a negative view of Wall Street? Is that what we're talking about in general?
I think to a large extent, yes. And if you think about the movies, right, the movie Wall Street, which is sort of the famous one, or The Wolf of Wall Street, you know, all mm-hmm. these stories. I mean, you hear the negative stories. That's what gets publicized more than the positive things that come out of the financial markets. And so I do think that there is somewhat of a view that if you graduate from college and go to Wall Street, you're selling out. There's obviously been a very large push in the legal profession on Wall Street and other areas for diversity, equity, and inclusivity. Mm-hmm. And during the pandemic, I was involved in a Monday night cocktail party where we all got on Zoom and brought our cocktail and brought stories. And there were a lot of pretty big financial luminaries on mm-hmm. that call. I was mm-hmm. I was like the baby. How I got involved with all these Alta Cockers, I don't know. But I was on this call, and there was one guy who was head of a very prestigious law firm. And he said, look, I can't hire the diverse people that I want to hire because they're all going to work for NGOs. Mm-hmm. The people who want to come to a corporate law firm right out of school are not the candidates that I'm really looking yeah. for in that. So I think it's complicated, but I do think particularly with younger folks today, there's a view that if you graduate from college or business school and you go to Wall Street, you're selling out.
So the stereotype of Wall Street, I mean, you've had your own path. Do you believe the stereotype? I mean, is the stereotype true for you? Or it seems like you've had a much more sort of, like, it's a normal path for you and people have a different impression of Wall Street. That's my impression.
I mean, for me, it was a means to an end.
Yeah.
You know, would I have had potentially more fun running an art gallery? Maybe, mm-hmm. but it wouldn't have afforded me the lifestyle that I've been mm-hmm. able to achieve and the other things that have filled out my life in such a big way.
So, I mean,
for me, it was a means to an end.
And you wanted to make money. And we don't like to say that.
You know, as I said, if I didn't want to make money, I probably wouldn't have chosen Wall Street.
And but it's, see, this is another thing, ladies. I mean, everybody, this person is actually admitting they want to make money. Who doesn't want to make money? And she has done what it takes, you know?
I mean, I was in, and we've talked about this, but I was in a documentary that, had I known what the filmmaker Lauren Greenfield was going to do with it, I never would have agreed to be a part of it. But because she turned my story into,
she had her own issues.
She had her own issues, but she turned the story. She made it about money. It was supposed to be empowering women, and the project changed over the years, and she wasn't very forthcoming about it. But I have to say, in that documentary, I'm quoted in the trailer out of context, but then if you watch the documentary, you know, everybody, if you read the Federalist Papers, right, what the founding fathers, mm-hmm. our nation, founding fathers of our nation said was that, you know, if I want to go to Wall Street and work really hard because I want to make a lot of money, that's okay. And if I also want to live on the banks of the Mississippi barefoot and fishing for my food, that's up to me. And the sacrifices I make to make the money going to Wall Street, whether it's long days, late nights, traveling, as I mentioned, waiting to have a child, which I did, that's also my choice. And that was the choice I made.
Right, right. But I find it very parallel to the same way I feel about women who are sex workers or strippers or whatever, like especially artists that do that so they can have more time to do their art or whatever they want. And they are criticized for that. And it's really kind of the same thing. I mean, if you want to dance or do whatever you want to do to make a living, and you're in control of that, you're not doing it, you're doing it clearly, because most strippers, newsflash, strippers do it because they're doing it for the money. They're not trying to show off, okay?
And I agree with that.
I think it's the same thing. But I think, I wonder if men are more like, they're okay if women are stripping, but they don't want to be making money.
I mean, look,
too much power. That's money and power. I mean, those things are together. But I want to get to you as a mom.
Sure.
So tell me how your career, tell me how you've said that your career really, you really changed your attitude about your career when you became a mom. And tell me how it changed and what you, if you had thought beforehand it was going to change that way, or what happened inside for you? What happened to you?
So, as we've talked about, my path to becoming a mom was a really rough and rocky one.
Yes.
I did 25 rounds of IVF, which is not only very physically taxing, it's very expensive, as you know. I joke that they're going to sing Million Dollar Baby at my daughter's bat mitzvah, and that's before private school. So I did 25 rounds of in vitro. I ultimately needed to use a surrogate because I miscarried. And you know, look, I waited. I started trying to get pregnant mm-hmm. at 39.
You clearly wanted to be a mom.
I wanted to be a mom. I had always wanted to have a child from the time I was 15. Mm-hmm. And I knew that my stepmother did not have children. And it was something I think to this day she regrets. Mm. Having lived through that and knowing that, I always knew I wanted to be a mom. And life just got away from me. And I would have done it sooner had I sort of known. Mm-hmm. you know, for everybody listening out there too, I mean, I used to think that 40 was the magic cutoff. It's really 35.
You know? Okay.
So I tell every young woman, if you're not in a relationship in your early 30s, you know, freeze your eggs, and you're very lucky to have that opportunity now. The technology didn't exist when I was in my early 30s. And so my daughter was ultimately carried by a surrogate, and she was born severely prematurely. She came at 26 weeks, right? Pregnancy's 40 weeks. She weighed 2.5 pounds and was in the hospital in Tampa, Florida. Surrogacy was still illegal in New York. It's in the last year, I think it's become legal in New York. But so she was born in Tampa, Florida. I ended up living in the hospital room with her, sleeping on the couch for 69 days. And certainly the first half of that, I didn't know if we didn't know if she was going to make it. We didn't know if she was going to be developmentally have problems. We didn't know if she was going to be have cerebral palsy or autism, or, you know, a lot of the things that premature babies can have. If she could go blind, I mean, there's a lot of risks. And the journey in the NICU is a very tumultuous one. And I think I developed such a bond with her during that time that when I brought her back to New York and was thinking about going back to work, I really, my head wasn't in it.
So you hadn't really expected to feel that way? Did you think you were going to be going, you know?
I thought I was going right back to work.
Wow. And so like being,
I was going to have a nanny and, you know, just, I was going to go back to work. And,
but your experience in being a mom just really like somehow just.
I had been at the company that we sold, so I was lucky from that perspective that I had some financial security and could take time off from my career. And I don't think that I ever thought being a mom was going to be as fulfilling as it's been.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about that. Tell us what's good about it.
You're really seeing the world through a child's eyes, and the wonder and learning of this being that you brought into the world that starts out effectively as a blank canvas on some level. It's just really powerful. I don't know how else to describe it, but you know, when they're babies, right? They eat, sleep, poop.
Yeah.
But they're cute, you know. But then all of a sudden one day when they start talking, that it's a person and it's your person. And you feel that, at least for me, I felt this tremendous sense of responsibility and wanting to give her, you know, most importantly, the sense of security and being loved and, you know, a home environment, but also then giving her every opportunity to become the person that she wants to be. I mean, I really do believe our job, and my father taught me this. I remember we talked earlier about how he said, you've got to go out and make it in the world on your own. You know, I was a little resentful of that in my 20s. I thought, you know, why are you asking me for the $20 back that I borrowed from you last weekend? You can afford the $20. But he wanted to instill in me that level of responsibility and self-confidence and knowing that I could take care of myself. And I remember being in my early 30s and my father saying, do you realize it would have been easier for me to just write checks?
Yeah.
Than deal with your bullshit or being unhappy that I was treating you this way. But he said, my job as a parent was to make sure that if I dropped dead tomorrow and the money was all gone because I had screwed up or invested badly, that you could make it on your own. And, you know, he really believed that. And it was the best gift he ever gave me, to be frank, was making me independent. And I'm hoping to instill the same things in my daughter.
And you try to expose her to as many things as you, I mean, you take her traveling a lot. She's very involved in, tell me about, so she's an actress. She's 11 years old, guys.
Trying to be an actress.
Or whatever. So how did that come about? And what's that like as a mom? Like, and how does she handle it? Is it a lot of pressure? Does she put, How can you, I guess what I'm wondering about is, it sounds like that is such a, it makes me nervous as somebody who never had.
Makes me nervous as her mom.
Never had kids. It's like, that just seems like it's so fraught with ups, you know, the ups and downs and rejection and things going great and then things not, how do you deal with all that? What happens? And
well, I think I've always said out of adversity can come tremendous opportunity, right? And I think that the rejection that these any actor, frankly, it's not just child actors, I think builds resilience and great life skills. And I say to people that if, you know, her acting experience ends up being nothing more than getting her first chair on the debate team, it's a win.
Mm-hmm.
Because she'll overcome the fear of public speaking and you know, develop that level of confidence. But mm-hmm. the rejection is also a positive thing, right? Because mm-hmm. you have to, we all get rejected. We get rejected by men, women, you know, in relationships. We
dogs.
Get rejected by dogs. We get rejected
dog never
by
liked me.
Jobs. And you have to learn how to bounce back from that. And so, but going back to your question, how it came about is really that I started taking her to see Broadway shows when she was very young, and she loved it, right? At mm-hmm. 11, she's seen, I think, 37 or 38 Broadway shows.
Oh,
and,
my God.
That's something that we really enjoy doing together. And I'm a big believer in providing experiences to kids rather than stuff.
Yeah.
Right? Because the stuff doesn't really mean that much, and the experiences can mean a tremendous amount. And same goes for traveling. But as a result of this experience in the theater, and we knew some people in the theater, and before pre-pandemic, we'd always go backstage because I would
oh,
know
wow.
somebody who knew somebody.
Oh.
Sadly, there really is no backstage now because of still COVID. They worry. But but we met a bunch of people in the business, and then the pandemic happened. And I remember lying in bed the night that lockdown started and thinking about people I knew in the theater, because what do actors do when they're not working, right? They waiter, they cater waiter, they babysit. There's none of that, right? I thought, what are all these people that I know going to do? And I had this thought that if I could put together a camp for kids that probably weren't going to be able to go to camp that summer because of this shutdown, I could hire and employ a bunch of these out-of-work people. So actually, my best friend's sister is a Tony-nominated choreographer, and she runs something called the World Dance Movement, and she actually trained Andy Blankenbuehler, who's the choreographer of Hamilton.
Mm.
And I called my friend Jeff and I said, do you think Mish would be interested in doing something like this? Because she knows all these people and she knows how to do something like this. And she did. And so that summer we employed 27 out of work actors, dancers, singers, and had about 70 students.
Wow.
We even had one little girl in Pasadena who would get up at 6 a.m. because she wanted to train with the level of professionals that we have.
Wow.
And we had the guy who played the king in Hamilton. We had an acting coach from Nickelodeon. And my daughter obviously attended the camp that summer, and the acting coach from Nickelodeon called me and said, your daughter's really talented. You know, is this something she might want to pursue? And she has. And
that's a thumbs up.
And yeah. Although she hasn't got a job at Nickelodeon yet, but we'll see. But I put it to her that if it's something that she wanted to do, I would support her. And it was very similar to the way my father handled my ice skating career, right? He would come into my room at 5 a.m. and say, feet on the floor. And if I wasn't ready to leave when it was time to go to the rink, he would say, you're not doing this for me. And mm-hmm. he would leave. And so I do the same thing with her. Now, there are people that she has to be responsible to. She has a manager. So when an audition comes in, you got to do it. You can mm-hmm. choose that you don't want to pursue acting anymore. But as long as you want to pursue acting, you don't get to say, I'm not in the mood today. And I think it instills a lot of responsibility in a young, in a young kid. And I think it's really good for her.
Yeah, yeah, and she gets.
But the minute she says, "Mommy, I don't want to do this anymore," okay, you're sure, because you can't have it both ways.
Right, right, right. So
because it is a job,
right? But she's obviously self motivated, and I think that's a really huge difference between putting pressure on a child and a child that is trying to express themselves, right?
100%. And I mean, we've been on sets where you see some of these mothers that are living vicariously through their children and pushing their children and yelling at their children on set and being nasty to the other mothers, by the way, because we're just competition and we don't come at it from that perspective at all. We're doing this because it's something she loves and wants to do.
Do you have a story or an example of a disappointment that she might have had and how you helped her navigate that?
You know, it's tough on the acting side only because so much of the auditions today are self-tape and MP3s. They're not going on go-sees like they did in the old days.
Yeah.
So
self-tapes.
It's kind of like if you don't get the job, you just don't hear.
That's good.
It is good because it sort of goes into the ether and There's not the, you didn't get it.
Does she express like, I'm disappointed, or does she get frustrated that, you know, she's a creative person. We're all frustrated that we're not doing better. Does she express that, or how does an 11-year-old handle that? I can't handle it at my age.
I think she just lets it go. I think, again, I do think because she's not going physically and sitting in front of a casting director, I'm taking a tape with my cell phone.
Right.
And then I'm submitting it.
Right.
They don't feel the rejection in the same way.
Oh,
it's
wow.
harder.
That's good.
Because it's hard to do those self-tapes when you don't have the personal interaction with the person.
Absolutely.
On the other side. But I think it obfuscates the disappointment of not getting the job because it's not so obvious.
Right. Yeah. No, that is a good thing.
But she gets really excited when she gets a job.
Yeah. And she puts a lot into it, I bet. Does she?
She puts a lot into it, but it, you know, again, it's creating a sense of responsibility. I mean, she gets a paycheck. And the first paycheck she got is, she's like, Mommy, I thought I made $500 for that job. Why is the check for, you know, $280? I said, well, the manager takes a cut. The government takes a cut. There's a mandatory amount that has to go directly to your trust that you never see. The government takes a cut? But it's a good life lesson, right?
Yeah. No, I mean, I think this is all good. I think she's got a very rich, she's having a very, very rich childhood. I mean, you know, all those experiences, and I think a lot of it is because you're open to so many things. I think a lot of parents are really afraid and they, you know, they keep their kids away from things. And I think she's pretty damn lucky.
She's very lucky.
You know, I keep coming back to something that you said earlier that I just want to touch on. And you said that working was a means to an end for you. And I want to point out to everybody that, you know, you work on Wall Street. Who isn't, when we work for money, guys, working for 99% of us is a means to an end. And I don't think anyone that is in your position should be in feel any differently than, like, you know, when I was an art director. Okay. I mean, you enjoyed what you do, right? You get satisfaction out of it.
You know, it's a competitive business. And I think my background as an athlete, I like to win. So when I get someone to invest in the product I'm representing, for example, right, that feels like winning.
Right.
So it's very satisfying. But at the end of the day, the monetary reward is higher than a lot of other professions.
Yes. But so, I mean, so what, really? You're good at something that happens to make money. And I just.
I'm not ashamed of it. But
no, I don't. I'm just saying, like, I feel like that you've probably heard that. I just really want to point out how important it is to feel empowered, and that by saying that it doesn't, by saying that it's a means to an end, it feels like whose job isn't a means to an end? And because you're making money, good money, that, like, it's not in a different category. Okay, guys? Okay. Women making money is a good thing. We want women to have power.
I think it is a good thing. And I think I would also say there is still this view in society. You know, people walk into my apartment and they think I divorced it or inherited it.
Yeah.
And I'm like, guess what, guys? This is the house that I built.
Yeah. No, see, this is what I'm saying, which is so obnoxious. And I wanted to, we have 10 minutes left. So I wanted to get to this other topic, which I'm curious about from your point of view, is having much more modest career or whatever. But I have felt a lot of times that men are really, I feel like they underestimate really smart women as successful women. I think they meet them and, like, somebody like you who's, you know, attractive and, you know, they probably just think, oh, you know, they may underestimate you. And then when they find out how smart and powerful you actually are, it's threatening to them. And I was wondering if
there's
if
no
you've
question.
Had that problem, and if you've had, like, men not want to date you, or what have you gone through in that situation?
I think that that's absolutely true. I think it is difficult for a lot of men. I think it was one of the issues in my marriage, you know, that I became during the marriage more successful than my former husband. And I think it created a lot of tension. I think that there is still a dynamic between men and women. I think it's hard for men to be with someone who's more successful than they are. Mm-hmm. And I think that the dynamic that results from it can be difficult in a relationship. And I've certainly experienced that. Mm-hmm. As a result, the pool of the folks that I date is probably smaller than it otherwise would be, because I just don't want to deal with those issues.
Mm-hmm. When you are thinking about dating somebody, do you think about, I mean, does it matter to you how much money they make, or what they do, or like, what do you look for?
I look for somebody who's in a similar category to myself, because I'm happy to pay my own way, but I think when you are paying for a man, it just creates a weird dynamic. Hey, it's certainly at this age. I think it's different in your 20s and 30s, but in your 50s, there's still that traditional view of male-female relationships. And, you know, it's how the men in the pool of people that I were dating feel about it. And I've never been interested in dating someone significantly younger than myself. So,
right.
In fact,
right.
I've tended to date people who are older. My former husband was quite a bit older.
Yeah. I mean, I could see that, you know, you go on a trip together and, you're can easily afford certain things. I mean, that would make a difference. Have you, dated any men who, are, you know, clearly, you know, less successful, or?
Well, my ex-husband.
But you didn't start out that way.
We didn't start out that way. And I think that I thought when I met him, he was more successful than it turned out that he was. But he's very smart, by the way. Huh. But no, I generally have not. I've generally dated people more successful than myself, because that's something, for better or for worse, that attracts me.
Right. And I
grew up with a very powerful male figure in my life. My father was a very big, strong personality. And we were, as you mentioned earlier, very close. And there's, you know, for better or for worse, I think I've always held men up to his standard, which probably hasn't always been super healthy for me. But it is what it is.
Too good.
He was a hard act to follow.
Yeah,
you know,
for everybody.
My father passed away 7 years ago. My stepmother has not been on a date, and I doubt she ever will. You know, there's just, she, as she says, who, you know.
He does sound like a really.
He was very special. I was very lucky.
So we have 5 minutes left. Is there something like, what do you think, like, if you could tell women, say young women, what do you, like, you see a lot of women who are less confident, or maybe women who are smart that don't present themselves as powerfully as they could, like, what do you see the most that you could say women could work on?
I think don't be afraid of your femininity. Doesn't make you weak.
And
I think there's a perspective that we have, that some young women have today, that they have to be just like the boys. I don't think you do. I think that's a negative. To be confident, believe in yourself. Again, don't think of yourself as male or female. We're all working at the same job. We're all potentially as smart. You know, I know you and I talked a little bit about transgender athletes, which is something that I have an issue with. But playing chess, an intellectual pursuit, there aren't differences between men and women. We shouldn't even really be bringing that into the conversation.
What, and I respect what you're saying, and I believe you for you, but there are a lot of women that do, particularly among young women, or I've seen it certainly many, many times in corporate environments, where young women will flirt, or, you know.
Absolutely.
And to get ahead and get rewarded for that. What do you say about that?
It's not a good path to go down. I think that it's a slippery slope. And I think the world is so conscious today of not allowing that stuff, because the men, as we said before, are afraid of getting into trouble. It doesn't work the way it used to, but it doesn't mean you have to wear a black suit every day. You can wear a pretty dress. You can curl your hair. You can be feminine and still be confident and strong and smart.
So you don't think that, so I'm just trying to like put it all together. This is a lot to think about. I'm trying to process all this.
I'll have to come back.
But I guess so. So like, I mean, I have seen women get ahead through flirting. I mean, it actually makes me, I'm actually kind of angry and bitter about it, frankly.
There's no question.
I'm not good at it.
Listen, I worked with somebody years ago who ended up suing the firm over the glass ceiling, and she was sleeping with our boss.
Yeah, those are the women that often complain. And why do you say it's a slippery slope? Can you explain that?
Because you'll be viewed as someone who is trying to use your feminine wiles as opposed to your smarts. And ultimately, that's not really respected in the business world.
So you think it's pretty demeaning. Transparent?
It's totally transparent.
Do you see people sleeping with their bosses still? Do you think
not as much less? Because I think that there's too much on the line for the bosses.
Yeah. Yeah. That used to, I mean, I've certainly. So before we, I really, really, I mean, I can't tell you how appreciative I am of you.
Oh, you're
I'm
so
going
sweet.
To use the word slumming it here.
Oh, come on. I love it. I love Brooklyn. This is awesome.
No, really. It's been invaluable. Like I knew it would be, but I just want to make sure that that we get to talk about the things that you want us to know about, like brought your
museum,
the museum. And your daughter has an Instagram. We can,
my
keep
daughter.
Up with.
Yep. You can follow her adventures on her Instagram, which is at Sydney B's Broadway. Her name is Sydney B, so SydneyBasBway. I run the account in full transparency, so it's controlled. But you know, if you meet her, she might tell you, my mom runs that account. Don't think it's me posting, but it'll you can follow our adventures. And then, yeah, I became a founding member of a new museum called the Museum of Broadway.
How long has that museum been around?
It opened last November, so we're not even a year old. It's
Tell
you know, right off of Times Square, three floors. We have different rooms dedicated to iconic shows, whether it's the Ziegfeld Follies, Phantom, Rent, the original dress from Annie, the little red dress.
Wow.
Lots of memorabilia. The bottom floor is all dedicated to what goes into the making of a show.
Wow.
You can spend an hour or 5 hours there, depending on if you want to watch all the videos. But I got involved and when I went to the opening, I was really, really blown away by what a phenomenal job these people did. And, it's very interactive. You know, there's a Lion King room where you can put an Instagram filter with the headdress. There's in the Rent room, you can pick up the payphone and listen to the actors talking about their journey and their roles and lots more. But they have a fabulous website. And I really encourage anyone who has any interest in Broadway at all. We just added Leah Michelle's costume from Funny Girl.
Oh, my goodness.
And Ben Platt's costume from Parade, which was an incredibly powerful show. It's amazing that it had never been done before. But it's I'm biased, but I think it's a special place.
Yeah, it sounds like we needed that.
Yeah.
Is it doing well? It sounds like
it's starting to. We're getting a lot
I've never
of terrific.
Heard about it.
I know a lot of people haven't heard about it. I mean, we get a lot of press. They've done a great job on social media, but we need more visitors to keep it going. But
okay, the museumofbroadway.com spelled out. All right, we got to go. Thank you so much for listening today. Check me out on Instagram, Dr. Lisa Levy SP, and go to the archives. I've got.